about in Parshas Ekev. There's three psukim. 5776. Was that like a test, or you wanted for this? I got it. The land that you are coming to inherit is not like the land of Egypt, that you just left. Which you will plant your plantings, and you'll have to water it by foot. In other words, going by foot, like a vegetable field. That's what Egypt is like, where you have to water it with your own water right there. But the land that you are going to inherit, Eretz Harim of Goz, it's a land filled with mountains and valleys. You can't walk there to go water it. Limtara Shemayim Tishamayim, it's going to need rainwater to feed the fields. It is a land that Hashem is searching always. Continuously, the eyes of Hashem are upon it. From the beginning of the year until the end of the year. So Rashi tells us that this land, Eretz Yisrael, is better than Egypt. Why? Because the Jews loved the land of Egypt because it was a very beautiful land. There were fruits all along the Nile Delta. And if you check it out, if you go look on like some map thing, whatever you want, if you look at Egypt from a satellite, it is the coolest thing in the world. How the entire area of Egypt is pure sand. Desert area completely, except the Nile Delta. As it goes up, there's one strip of beautiful, lush lands that go all around the Nile River. And then when the Nile River splits off, it's beautifully green with plants and fruits and everything else that grows right around there. That's what Egypt looked like, and that's where the people lived. They didn't live in the desert area of Egypt. They lived in the beautiful land of Egypt. And they wondered, could Canaan be any better than that? How could Canaan be any better than that? Hashem assured them that even the worst land of Eretz Yisrael, which is Hebron, which is a rocky land, which is why they used it for Beit HaKvaros, for funeral homes, right? Even that land is better than the best land of Mitzrayim, which was Pisom and Ramses, the areas where the Jews lived, Goshen and that area. What was so great about the land? Here's the greatness. Mitzrayim does not get rain. If they get rain, the rain comes once in a blue moon. Barely ever happens. So when they want to water their fields, they need to take buckets and pour it from one place to the other, to take the water and to pour it over everywhere. So that's the area, and you have to work really hard and go from one place to the other. In Eretz Canaan, there's mountainous regions. You can't do such a thing. Artificial watering holes are going to be impossible to find on top of a mountain. So therefore, everyone relies on rain. HaKadosh Baruch Hu does all the work while you sleep. Hashem is doing all the work. You don't have to do anything. So here's the greatness of Eretz Yisrael. You don't have to work hard if you live there to have your fields filled with water. That's the greatness as Rashi of how great Eretz Yisrael is. Reverse Shagan, even though they made tributaries and all these canals throughout Egypt for the waters of the Nile River to go from one place to the other, there were 100,000 water wheels that were still in use by the year 1870 when Reverse wrote his Sefer. Reverse said, you have to use your feet to push the water wheels to make the water from the Nile River go into those canals and make it go. Now we have machinery to do so. But at that time, it was still really difficult, up until the 20th century, the middle of the 20th century, it was still really difficult to be able to go through and find a place in Egypt where it was easy for them to water their fields. In Eretz Yisrael, it was a lot easier. That's the first way of looking at the pasuk. God made it easier for us to live in Israel. Number two, the Orach Chaim HaKadosh says there were a lot of fruits and vegetables in that land. But the pshat is like this. Eretz Mitzrayim might have been a beautiful land physically. Eretz Canaan is a beautiful land spiritually. So in other words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying, you want to know what the beauty of Eretz Yisrael is? Eretz Canaan, Eretz Yisrael is supposed to be that it has a beauty spiritually that other lands do not have. That's what this land has. That's what makes it so special. The Shulchan Aruch actually brings down in Orach Chaim, Chavkuf Nun Aleph Siv Gimel. It talks about washing clothes during the week of Tisha B'Av. We didn't have a Shavuot Shechal Bo in this past year. There was no week that Tisha B'Av fell out on, because when Tisha B'Av falls out on Shabbos, then as we all know, it gets pushed off to Sunday. The actual Tisha B'Av is Sunday. It's not like a nidche where you have shivas and tamas. This actually is a real big machlokas between the Rivash and, well, others, Rishonim. But nonetheless, it seems that Tisha B'Av was actually on Sunday, which means there is no Shavua Shachal Bo. There is no week of Tisha B'Av. So Sfardim lucked out this year. They didn't have to worry about anything this year. When it's Shavua Shachal Bo, you didn't have a problem. Therefore, you could cut your nails even the week of Tisha B'Av itself, because there is no official week of Tisha B'Av. And washing clothes for Sfardim was mutter during that time. So he says, this is what the Shulchan Aruch says, you can wash your clothes in Bavel. Why? Because in Bavel, the water is dirtier because it's more stagnant water, and because of that, it's not the same type of cleaning that you'll get as you will in Eretz Yisrael. That's how the Or HaChaim puts it. Meaning, mountain water and hill water, water that comes from rainfall, is cleaner than water that sits in a river or a lake, which has dirt all over the place and bringing it from one place to the other. That's another reason, a third reason why Eretz Yisrael is better. Because the rainwater makes the water cleaner and better to drink than anywhere else. Part of those who quote scientists that rainwater is much more beneficial for plants and trees than anything else. He quotes scientists on that. I looked it up. It's true. Rainwater has a much lower pH level. For anybody who's ever had a fish tank, you'll know that a pH level is what kills your fish. If you don't change your water often, then the pH level is just going to rise with the amount of ammonia and nitrates and nitrites that are inside the water. It's eventually going to kill all your fish. The pH, which stands for, well, I have it like over here, it is a numeric scale used to specify the acidity or basicity of an aqueous solution. I said that three times fast, by the way. But, yes, that it does. But regardless, that, it's much better than tap water. Drinking tap water will have a higher pH level. Usually, the rainwater is going to be in the 4 or 5s in a pH level. This, by tap water, usually have 6 or 7. 6.0 to 7.0, maybe even a little bit higher, depending. So in Chicago, I don't know if you've ever seen a fish tank that has those angel fish inside there. The water in Chicago is extremely hard when it comes to this pH level and the base, all the different nitrates and nitrates here. Thank you. All right. That's awesome. But it's very, very difficult to be able to have angelfish in our water because of those issues. It's extremely difficult in that way. Regardless, but that's the idea. The Zohar says that the reason why this is so, all the waters in the world pass through Gehenna before they come out to the rest of the world. Like Lake Michigan is all Gehenna water, and then it comes up at some point. In Eretz Yisrael, all the waters skip over Gehenna, and they don't go through Gehenna, which is why the water is better in Eretz Yisrael than anywhere else. But that's the third answer as to why Eretz Yisrael is better than anywhere else. This is the Ibn Ezra. Another milah that Eretz Canaan has over Egypt is that there was a need all year long to take care of it. Eretz Yisrael, because it needed rain, and everything agriculturally based itself on rain, and they didn't have any real rivers or lakes to be able to base themselves off of. Obviously, it was the Kinneret, there was the Jordan River, but there's not a lot throughout Eretz Yisrael. In order for them to survive, there needed to be enough rain that they could pay attention all year long. That's what it means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was Doresh it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was paying attention and making sure that it was happening in the right way because of all the issues over here. Mitzrayim pretty much took care of itself. And there were huge amounts of water areas there. The Nile River with all the delta and all the areas around took care of every person that lived in Mitzrayim, and you were fine on your own. So here's the shot. We said before that Eretz Yisrael is better because why? Because the rain falls on your own. You don't have to do anything. Here's another one. If the water is already there and you don't have to daven for it, then it's like the Nachash. The Nachash was given a curse. What was the curse? That he would eat the dirt of the ground. That the dust and dirt of the ground will be his food. Now where's the curse in that? That's awesome. That means you're always able to eat. Wherever you go, you'll be able to eat something. You'll have dust and dirt everywhere. So why is that a curse of the snake? And the Pshat says all the Rishonim, all the Achronim, everybody says the exact same thing. Because the key is to have a relationship. If you're not davening for it because your food is so plentiful that you don't have to ask for it anymore, so there's no relationship with God over it. We're missing something because there is no one here who has ever really been hungry. Yeah, you might have gone into a situation once where you went, I don't know, 24 hours without food because you fasted Yom Kippur. And that's it. And then after Yom Kippur, it's not the same because you know that you're going to pig out right after Yom Kippur is over. You know how much you're going to eat. Back then, you had nothing. There were people that literally lives off nothing. We have no idea what starvation is. So when we say Borech Aleinu Hashem Elokeinu Et Hashanah Hazos, we're really asking HaKadosh Baruch Hu, please help me get to $300,000 for my gross income for the year. I really would appreciate it if you got me up to $300,000. Well, we are the richest. We are richer than the richest. The poorest of us are richer than the richest of people that lived 150 years ago. We're ridiculous in how much money we make. And I know, and it's still not enough because of tuition. Thanks, guys. But either way, but that's Hashem's curse, yeah.
Yeah, but some arguments to make because how's that relevant? In the sense that you could say that the poorest person today on Medicaid has better health care than Rothschild
or bathroom and a sink. That's all you have to say.
Yeah.
A bathroom and a sink.
Can
you imagine? Yeah. Air conditioning and heating. It's not even a Shiloh when it comes to that. We're living more comfortably than the kings of 150 years ago.
Right.
More comfortably. That's the argument.
No, so my point is, it's all relative to the time
that you live in. No, you're 100% right. And in that sense, what we're saying over here is that's the Nachash's curse. We are living the Nachash's curse. We don't even think about this anymore. We feel no need to have a relationship with our HaKadosh Baruch Hu to ask for food, because we automatically think we have food. We have running water at all times, which is clean, already cleaned for us. We don't have to do anything. It's already completely and utterly clean. That's not something that anybody has to daven for. 100 years ago, no one had clean water. And if you did have clean water, it was probably filled with dysentery and you were going to die. That was the likelihood. So it's something that's just there. The mashal given is a king who has two children. It's given by all the midrashim. The king has two kids. One kid is a really good kid and he loves that kid. The other kid he hates. It's one of those kids that you just can't deal with. Right? You know what I'm talking about. Yeah. He knows. So otherwise, you have those two kids that are sitting right there. So the kid that is so that he wants to deal with, he tells him, I'm giving you $1 a day. I'm giving you one piece of food per day. And every day the guy would have to come back to the king and he has to say to the king, can I have my food? Can I have my money? And every single day the king had a relationship with him because he wanted to see him. The other kid, he gave him all the food he needed for the year and just sent him away. Said, here's what you need, just get out. That's the idea. Eretz Yisrael is the kid, the son that everybody wants to be around. He's the son that's right there. While unfortunately, Eretz Mitzrayim is the other one that goes the other way. And that leads straight into the next parsha. That's the idea, says Ibn Ezra. But conversely, if we want to take this the other way, that gets very scary. If a Kadosh Baruch Hu is always looking at Eretz Yisrael, always paying attention to it, Tamid Einei Hashem Elokecha Ba, God is always watching over it. That means that as much as He'll reward us when we do well, that means He's also going to immediately punish us when we do wrong. If you're in the king's palace and you do something wrong, you're going to be punished much more severely than if you're in the courtyard that's way outside, because the courtyard is something different. I'm standing in front of the king's throne and I'm still sinning. A sin in Eretz Yisrael is worse, 10 times worse, than a sin outside of Eretz Yisrael. And the Rashbam, the Abiezri, they all say the exact same thing. The idea is, if you follow His word, then you're going to be successful immediately, because that's what Eretz Yisrael is like. And that's what it is. And if not, then it's going to be very harrowing for the people that live there. The Ramban says that tefillos and mitzvos allow the land to grow. And that's what ends up happening, naturally speaking. Without Torah and mitzvos, by definition, the land will not grow. That's how the Ramban says it. It just won't happen. Nature will not occur. It won't happen, because if there's no Torah and mitzvos there, there's no ability for there to be rain. If there's no ability for there to be rain, nothing can happen in that area. Then it brings the Medrash Rabbah where two men realize that their grain is being destroyed by vermin. There are rats and mice that are eating up their grain. And at first they laughed. They thought people were stealing it. But they see it was just rats and mice. And they're like, wait, but the rats and mice are stealing all of our stuff. What are we going to do? They went to Reb Pinchas ben Yair, who had the ability to talk to mice. Reb Pinchas ben Yair went to the mice, spoke to the mice. There are two times where he does this. One is by the king who lost a ring, and one of the mice swallowed it, and he came and took it out. There's a very similar story with the Rambam that probably is a folklore. But the Gemara in Yerushalmi brings down by Reb Pinchas ben Yair. Reb Pinchas ben Yair spoke to the mice and said, why are you eating the grain? And the mice squeaked because they're not giving trumas and maestros. If you don't give trumas and maestros in Eretz Yisrael, this is what happens to you. Said Rabbi Nosbanyar, you have to go do it. When something happens that's wrong, says then it's it. That's what it's going to be like for Bnei Yisrael. The Or HaChaim points out that the word Elokecha is used. It's your God to indicate that Eretz Yisrael is special only when we do what we need to do inside it. The Drisha is unique to Eretz Yisrael in that sense. Golos and the Shechina, it's just not the same. In Eretz Yisrael, this is where it happens. So I'm going to give you something regarding Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens. He visited Eretz Yisrael in 1867 and published his impressions. Now, this is not only about Israel. He visited a ton of places. But he visited Israel as well, and he described a desolate country, devoid of both vegetation and human population. No landscape exists that is more tiresome to the eye than that which bounds the approaches to Yerushalayim. If anyone's been in Highway 1 going to Yerushalayim, you honestly have no idea what he's talking about. But he's saying nothing is more tiresome to the eye. Jerusalem is mournful, dreary, and lifeless. Palestine sits in sackcloth and ashes. A desolate country whose soil is rich enough but is given over wholly to weeds. A silent, mournful expanse of desolation. We never saw a human being on the whole route. Hardly a tree or shrub anywhere. Even the olive tree and the cactus, those fast friends of a worthless soil, had almost deserted the country. A fast walker could go, we've had these discussions quite a bit, a fast walker could go outside the walls of Yerushalayim and walk entirely around the city in 1 hour. I don't know how else to make one understand how small it is. According to these Rishonim, these quotes make a ton of sense. That the land literally, like a tzvi, right, the way that the Medrash describes it, shrinks itself, makes itself disgusting, makes it without Torah mitzvahs, it just won't grow. Naturally speaking, there will be nothing there.
Now,
yeah, that's definitely true. The Ottomans, when they put up the wall 400 years ago, those walls, right, are the same ones that he's referring to. However, we have to point out that these quotes are taken completely out of context. You really have to read the entire thing of Samuel Comas to understand. His visit occurred during the middle of the hot Mediterranean summer. Imagine going to Israel in August and expecting there to be plants anywhere. There's no way. There's no way. I'm sorry? Yeah, it's just, it's not going to happen. It's difficult for anything to grow in the middle of August. The visit was also very, yeah, it could have been, it was Shemitah, but the visit was also very short and encompassed only areas that were cited in the Bible, which I would assume would be Hebron, maybe he went to Kevarachal, Jerusalem, those areas. I don't know where else he went. I don't know if he went to the agricultural areas that are all around, right? Also, he provided no statistical data, right, about Palestine's agriculture, the demographic makeup, or anything like that. Not only that, but Mark Twain didn't describe just Palestine that way. He described Greece, Lebanon, and Syria that way. Now, Lebanon and Syria, I would believe, are that way. I kind of believe that they're desolate wastelands with nothing that's worth it. But Lebanon isn't? Because it's cedar woods, right? Oh, so you say it's like the Hermon. Well, technically, that is biblical Israel. South Lebanon is biblical Israel, because that's where Dun was. That's where Shevet Dun was. It would be the northern Lebanon. Yeah, but he said even Greece.
If you had taken Lebanon, it would have stayed like the French Riviera of the Middle East.
That's what it would have been?
Yeah, it would have been beautiful.
Baruch Hashem, it didn't happen. So now, over here, so in that sense, right, he says like that, and now aside from that, there is no question that Mark Twain was a racist and a complete and utter anti-Semite. Concerning the Jews, he wrote the following: the Jewish race as having an unpatriotic disinclination to stand by the flag as a soldier. That means in Mark Twain terms, I don't know if you've ever read any of his books, but it means that we don't like to fight for other nations. If the concentration of the cunningest brains in the world, that's us by the way, was going to be made into a free country, I think it would be politic to stop it. It will not be well to let that race find out its strength. That's amazing. That's a line from Mark. So the Zionists that used Mark Twain's comments to prove that Israel should belong to us because Palestine under the hands of Arabs is desolate and whatever, Mark Twain himself was like, yeah, no. That's exactly what Mark Twain didn't want to happen. So if you want to take the words of a...
He wanted to happen for barriers for the Jews.
That's correct, right. That would. So if you want to take the words of a really, really angry racist and bigot, then yeah, 100%. That would be a good term. But that is, what I wanted to bring out of that is that does sort of prove what the Rishonim were saying, that with the Torah we have, without it's not. Either way, the Meshech Chochma literally says the exact opposite. The exact opposite. He says, Eretz Yisrael is unique, that the land is constant Ashkoch of Hashem at all times, even when we're not living there. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu is always taking care of Eretz Yisrael. Other lands only have the Ashkoch like this when we're living there, but not when we go out. Rav Elchanan Wasserman points it out, and it's true. I mean, this is from Navi. The Kusim went to northern Eretz Yisrael to take over where the 10 tribes were. Sennacherib took out the 10 tribes and brought in the Kusim. And the Kusim, because they weren't treating the land properly and doing evil things, were immediately eaten by lions. To which a Jew came and told them, if you keep the mitzvahs, if you're Megayer, then everything will work out. And they were Megayer in some type of way. I'm using the air quotes over here. They were Megayer. But clearly that has nothing to do with the Jews. The Kusim were not Jews. That's the idea behind it. So it's a strange, the Meshech Chochma says, it doesn't seem that way. We're not going to be Breslov. You're not going to hear this too often from me, so take this quote as a once-in-a-lifetime thing, is since Hashem is looking at the land, that's Eine Hashem Elokecha Ba, eyes are known as Chochma. The eye is a reference to Chochma, the wisdom of a person. For this reason, because God is always looking at Eretz Yisrael, Avira de Eretz Yisrael Machken. The airspace of Eretz Yisrael makes you a little bit wiser. When you get into Eretz Yisrael, you can think better. You can think straight. There's an ability to think things that you never would have had before. Chidushim can flow in a better way in Eretz Yisrael than they can in anywhere else. Elsewhere, the Achronim say that this concept comes, Avir Eretz Yisrael Machakim, comes from Moshe Rabbeinu looking at the land. That Moshe Rabbeinu was able to see the land. He wasn't able to go in. He was able to see the land before his death. But it seems like there's no contradiction. The Imre Emes is the third Gera Rebbe, the son of the Sfatam, says that Moshe Rabbeinu was on the level that Tmunas Hashem Yabit, the picture of God, he was able to see. That when Moshe Rabbeinu looked at something, it was like God was looking at something. And when that happened together, it's one and the same. Both of those, Moshe Rabbeinu looking and Hashem looking, is what causes the Avira de Eretz Yisrael to be Machakim. Those who have experienced it before, I'm telling you, there was one time where I was trying to figure out something. It was something in learning. I still can't remember. It was a Chiddush that I made in Shabbos, in one of the Agadot in Shabbos, and I could not think of it. And I was thinking of it while I was here in America. When I got to that sugya, when I was in Eretz Yisrael, immediately it popped into my head. It was the coolest thing. It wasn't even a question. It was like, oh, that's such a dumb question. Like, I can't even believe I was thinking of that. This is the obvious answer. And it was 100% the answer. It wasn't even a shiloh. It's awesome when you go there and you feel that. All right. And not only that, but everyone else's reign that comes to the world is based on Eretz Yisrael's reign, says Rashi, based on the Gemara in Tainus and Rosh Hashanah. The world gets its reign from the remnants of what we have over here. Now the Ramban calls this a sod amuk, a deep secret. And he says, it's nidreshes bakol v'hi hakol. It's searched out for everything, and it is everything. That Eretz Yisrael is absolutely everything. The Rabbeinu Machaya compares it to a person's heart. It's in the middle of the body where the chiyus is, and it spreads life to the rest of the body. The blood flow comes from the heart to the rest of the body, and that's what Eretz Yisrael is. Eretz Yisrael is literally the middle of the old world, right? Not including America on the other side. The middle of the old world, and it spreads its blood out to everywhere else, so to speak. The life that goes everywhere else. And what the Rabbeinu Machaya understands from that is that it's not under the powers of constellations or malachim or anything else that's out there. The power that a Kadosh Baruch Hu has in Eretz Yisrael is the power to keep it around and to make it special in and of itself. That's what it does, and refers to what we call the Beis HaMikdash above. Anybody who's done that Gemara Rosh Hashanah, where there's a Beis HaMikdash above that is opposite the Beis HaMikdash below, this is what it refers to over here. It says to Rabbeinu Bachai, this is the sodos, the secret behind it, but it's that a Kadosh Baruch Hu has a shkacha looking down at us at all times based on that idea. Rehearse though, connects in a much simpler way, and consider this, it's a really cool idea. Since this land connects us to Hashem and helps us remember that there's going to be a Malchus of Mashiach on earth, it benefits the whole world. When there's a drop that comes down to Eretz Yisrael, the whole world is affected. If this is Malchus Mashiach, the whole world gets something good from it. That's the idea behind it. The Chassam Sofer was asked in Tshuvas, Yoredea Reish Lamed Dalet. He says, why is it that God's eyes are in Eretz Yisrael, like we say over here, Ein Hashem Elokecha Ba, right? That the eyes of Hashem are on it. But by Yerushalayim, if anybody knows the pasuk, I'd be very impressed. Melachim Aleph and Perek Tes. Shlomo Melech says, Yerushalayim is Einai V'Libi Shom Kol HaYomim. My eyes and my heart is there all the days. There are songs based on those words. Einai V'Libi Shom Kol HaYomim. But what's the pshat? My eyes are in Eretz Yisrael, but my eyes and my heart are in Yerushalayim. So set the chassam over, I don't know. I'm not sure. But he says it's possible that eyes refer to the Beis Din Shomayla, while the eyes and heart is the pure Hashkacha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That goes against the Rabbeinu Bachaya. Rabbeinu Bachaya says that his constant Ashkocha is in Eretz Yisrael. It says the Chassam Sofer, no, the constant Ashkocha is in Yerushalayim. Eretz Yisrael has something, Hashem is paying attention to it, there's Beis and Shomayla taking care of it, but it's not the same as in Yerushalayim. The Yerushalayim is more special in that sense. That's how the Chassam Sofer says it. Now, I don't know if everybody here has done Tainus. There's a Gemara in Tainus in the third parak about Nachdiman Ben Gurion. The Gemara asks why Nachdiman Ben Gurion was named the way that he was, and Nachdiman Ben Gurion, because he made a note. He made like a hole in the sky for the sun to be there. What happened? So it's a famous story. It's around Daf Chaf Yutetz in Tainus, where Nachdim Ben Gurion went and needed to borrow wells of water for the Olei Regalim. There were people that were coming to do Aliyah L'Regel to Eretz Yisrael, and in order to get water, in order to have enough water there, right, what they needed to do is they needed to borrow wells. So he went to a certain non-Jew, and he said to him, I need to borrow 12 wells of water, and I'll pay you back with water. If I don't pay you back with water, then I'll pay for them. And he listed an exorbitant amount. It was in the 12 kikar kesef, which is a huge amount of money for the amount of wells that he was borrowing. Honestly, I don't know. Honestly, I have no idea. Yeah, it could be a reservoir, something like that. He needed water. Whatever it was, he said he would pay him back by a certain time. So the guy, on the day that it was due, where the loan was due, there was no rain. And it was a complete drought. Now, Tim McGorian had absolutely nothing, and he knew he was going to have to pay this crazy amount of money. So he told the guy, he's like, you got to wait for me. So in the afternoon, he came up to him again. The guy came up to Nachdim Megorian. The lender came up to Nachdim, and Nachdim said, I still have time during the day. At the end of the day, toward Mincha time, when everybody was going to daven Mincha, the guy came up to Nachdim and said, dude, you got to pay me. I mean, it's clear that it's not going to rain. Nachdim said, I still have an hour left. So the guy laughed at him, and he went to a bathhouse to go celebrate the fact that he had just, you know, gotten that much money. Nachdim Megorian went to the base of Mikdash. He davened at the base of Mikdash. He begged at Kadosh Baruch Hu. He said, I didn't do this for my own honor. I did it for the honor of your holy Beis HaMikdash from the Holy Regalim. Please, the Kadosh Baruch Hu, help me. And immediately the skies opened. The clouds filled up the sky. Oh, I should say that first. The clouds filled up the sky. The sky opened. These torrential rainfall came down, filled up all the wells up to the top, or however much water he needed in order to pay back the guy. And when the guy came out from the bathhouse, he went, and Nachdim Ben-Gurion was coming out from the Beis HaMikdash. They met each other. Nachdim Ben-Gurion said, you owe me for the extra water that just fell. He's making a joke, right? The guy turns to Nachdim and says, listen, I know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu just did a crazy miracle for you and that he's the one that brought the water. But I have a tine on you because I think it's after Shkia. It's after sunset and the water fell at my time. It's after the day is over. So Nachdim Ben-Gurion turned around and went right back to the Beis HaMikdash, davened to Hashem, and said, let your miracle be known to all the nations of the world. HaKadosh Baruch Hu spread the clouds of the sky and the sun was shining in the middle of the sky. Sounds like in the middle of the sky, even though it was already Mincha time, yeah, when the guy come up to him.
It's the middle of the horizon, meaning you can still see it before it goes down.
See, it's weird, because the Gemara says three times. The guy came to him in the morning, and then the middle of the day, and then at the afternoon, like, yeah, late afternoon.
Now it's like,
you're right, it could be like that. So it was just, it just seemed like time had passed, especially at that much of a downpour. Regardless, the sun was put up in the sky, and they called him because of that. No, I'm sorry?
Maybe
you used to see this. Yeah, that must be it. So they called him Nachdimon, and Nachdimon was because it was no kid the sun in the sky. He put up the sun in the sky. That's why his name was named Nachdimon Ben Gurion. Says the Chidah that's hinted to in our pasuk. The Chidah is an unbelievable gadol, and I'm an absolute worthless worm. Okay, I'm going to say that right now. But I would totally not understand this remez. I just don't get it. He says it's from the words, Lemut limtar hashamayim tishdem mayim. For the rain of the heavens, you will drink the water. He says it should be limtar hashamayim shosem mayim. You're drinking the water. Tishamayim sounds like you will drink the water. What does that mean? It should be you're drinking water right now from the rains of the heavens. That's what it should be. So we said, the promise is that you can rely on the rain of the sky to come down, that you will drink water in the future. And that's the hint for this story over here. Maybe I'm misunderstanding how he explains this remez. It's possible. I suggest you should look it up. Regardless, that's what he says over there. The last thing we're going to go through is a little bit of a bigger piece, but I'm not going to be able to do all of it over here. The words are mireshis hashana vad acharis shana. Okay, now listen to the words. Mireshis hashana ad acharis shana. The first shana is written hashana, the year. The last shana is written just shana without the year. Reishis is spelled without an aleph. There is an aleph missing in the word. Normally reishis is reish aleph shin yud sa. Here it's spelled reishis reish shin yud sa. So what does that mean? Why is it missing that? What's up with the hey? So Ibn Ezra says it's normal. This is what happens. Quite often you will see that an aleph is missing throughout the Chumash. You're going to see this idea and that there. The Paris Yosef says, for that reason, we're able to darshan gematrias that are off by one. Because an aleph missing doesn't mean anything. The famous line that they use for that is, Ephraim u'Menashe k'Ruvain v'Shimon yuli. Ephraim and Menashe are like Reuven and Shimon to me. Says Yaakov Avinu when he was giving them a bracha, that Ephraim and Menashe are like that. Ephraim and Menashe in gematria is the same gematria as Reuven and Shimon, but it's off by one. So the drush from that is that Ephraim and Manasseh, Karuv and Shimon, is that a gematria can be off by one. Says the Paris Yosef, it's really learned from the fact that the aleph is missing here, and there's no need. You can be missing an aleph, and that's okay. An aleph is a perfectly fine letter to be missing. That's how the Paris Yosef and Ibn Ezra says. Tosefes Bracha says it's possible that up until that point, they were always counting the beginning of the year from Nisan. Nisan was the beginning of the year. Why was Nisan the beginning of the year? Because that's when everybody knew that's when everything started. They left Mitzrayim, and everything went from Nisan. Tishrei was never known as the beginning of the year. And remember this, in the Torah itself, we never see that Rosh Hashanah is a day of judgment. It's never called a Yom HaDin. It's called Yom Teruah, where you blow the shofar. There is no mentioning, Yom HaZikaron is mentioned, but there's no mention of the dinim coming down, of the beginning of the year. That it doesn't mention anywhere. It never mentions where that the world was created in Tishrei. In fact, that's a machlokas Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Yoshua paskins that it starts in Nisan, Rabbi Eliezer says from Tishrei, and we paskin like Rabbi Yoshua. What's the napkin, you know? What's the napkin, you know? The beginning of the year is Nisan and not Tishrei? There's one naftamina. There's only one that I know. Birchas Hachama. You know that bracha that we make every 28 years on the sun? We do it in Nisan, not in Tishrei. Because Nisan is the beginning of the year, not Tishrei. That's the kasha of the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. That's exactly what the kasha is. The Gemara says it must be like Rabbi Eliezer. The Gemara says it. It's the low Karevi Yoshua, says the Gemara. And then we all say it. But it's strange because the Torah never hints to it. Says the parties those of the Tzephis Bracha, Rebbaruch Hashim. It is hinted to right here. Mirashis Hashanah without an Aleph is saying, and what it wants to say is that Rosh Hashanah, the Rosh Hashanah is the real Rosh Chodesh. It isn't yet. It's why it's missing the Aleph. But the real beginning of the year is really Tishrei, and it's a reference to that. Why Tishrei? Says the Baal HaTurim. Mi Reishis is the same letters as Mi Tishrei. Meaning Reishis, Reishin Yud Tzav, is Tishrei. That's the idea behind it. There's more to it than just that. There is the, where is it over here? Did I not put those little... Oh, I have it right over here. It's right over here. The Rokeach says Mirashis is the same gematria as Min Rosh Hashanah. And that's what it comes out over here. It's a crazy idea, but that's the pshat. That everything is learned up from over here, that Mirashis Hashanah starts from this point, from Rosh Hashanah, and it's learned from this pasuk where there's an aleph missing to hint to the fact that this is the real Rosh Chodesh, not the fake Rosh Chodesh. That's the aleph, so to speak, and trying to say that idea. Rav Wolfson said, that's why, after the Yomim Noraim, we can finally read Bereshit. Bereshit has the Aleph back. After the Yomim Noraim and everything's there, when we are starting off Berosh, poor, so to speak, now we can get into Bereshit and bring ourselves back. Moshe Zakeni says the following, and this is the Gemara, maybe you know it, from Beitza Tezayin of Beis. I wish I really had pure bitachon on this. A guy came up to me once and asked me, why don't we... Okay, I'll explain. There are three things that a person can spend all the money of the world on, and you will be guaranteed you'll be paid back for it. That no matter how much money you're promised on Rosh Hashanah, you will get your money back for these three things. Food for Shabbos and Yom Tov, food for Rosh Chodesh, and parnut for Torah. In other words, to pay for Torah. For your kids to learn, for your kids to go to school, etc. I think everybody is. Somebody came up to me and said, why does anyone try to get money off scholarship in order to pay for their kids to have, you know, for their tuition, if you're guaranteed to get the money back? So I said, honestly, I'm like, if I paid full tuition for all my kids, I would barely have any money left, period. And we're talking $14,000 per kid, right? I've got a lot of kids. That's a lot of people that I'm going to pay for with $14,000. That's a lot of money, right? So unfortunately, if I had pure bitachon, I'm sure everything would be fine, right? Everything would be okay. But I don't. I'm lacking in that bitachon. I'm missing on it.
You said your kids are public school.
I don't think that's bitachon. I'm pretty sure that's stupidity. I'm not about that. I don't know the nuances of the phrase. I'm pretty sure. But the Moshe of the Canaan says that's the word Reishis. Mi Reishis Hashanah. Reishis is Reish. It stands for Rosh Chodesh. Shin stands for Shabbos. Yud stands for Yom Tov, and Tov stands for Torah. That for those three things, Shabbos and Yom Tov together, you can pay for it, and you'll be guaranteed you'll get your money back. Everything's going to come back to you. It's an unbelievable amount. One thing that you could try. I'm sorry? Tzedakah is a different category. That's the challenge. Hashem said, test me with it. And so you can specifically test him with it. I don't know if you can test Hashem with Shabbos, Rosh Chodesh, and whatever. Hashav is what you're supposed to get something back instead. But I don't know if that's not a Gemara. That's not a Gemara that says you're going to get anything back. It's something else, but it's not referring to right over there. There's a Shlomo Kluge over here that goes through as well. By the way, regardless, we're first also mentioned something. The Drush in the Gemara, what the Gemara says, it's in Rosh Hashanah Tezayin. Any year that is poor in the beginning, Rush in the beginning, will be wealthy at the end. You'll be Misashereth in the end. Meaning, if it starts off badly, Kolas, Kolos, Kashos, all beginnings start off badly. In the end, everything's going to work out. Says Rav Hirsch, the reason why the Aleph is missing is to darshan this. Here's the pshat. In the beginning of the agricultural year in Israel, there are very little nutrients left in the ground from the year before. It's not like other lands where one season sort of like flows into the next, especially in America where it's raining all year long and there's nutrients all over the place. In Israel, the summer kills the land. It becomes so arid and so dry that there's nothing left. The nutrients are all soaked out of the ground and it's almost there. It's poor without an inheritance from the previous year. What that means is nothing will affect the new coming year, whether for good or bad, whether there's something bad in the ground or whatever it is. This hints that the character of the year is totally dependent on you. If you have a good Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, then things will work out in your land because there's nothing from previous years to affect it. It's not going to be that way. See, you could have a land where you have tons of weeds, and you're already going into the land with a negative issue. You have to deal with the weeds before you start plowing and planting and doing everything else you got to do. In our soul, it's not like that. You don't have those weeds. The weeds all died. You're starting over. So it's entirely with what you have right now. And that's the pshat. The more we realize that it's based on our behavior and what we do, the better it'll be for us. That's how Rav Hirsch understands that Gemara over there. Let's end with this Rav Schwab and Rav Wolfson over here. Mireshis Tashana until Acharis Shana. What's the pshat that there's a hay before the shana in the beginning, but none at the end? He says, in the beginning of the year, says Rav Schwab, we're all on a very high level. Start off the year on a high level. You start off the year on Rosh Hashanah. We're all davening in shul the whole time. We're sitting and we're eating and we're doing mitzvot the whole time. Rosh Hashanah, we're filling ourselves with mitzvot. Then we're coming up to Yom Kippur and then Sukkot. It's a tremendous time. We're bringing ourselves to a very high height. And then Ad Acharis Shana. At the end, it just becomes yet another year. It's not the same of what it was. In the beginning, it's Hashanah. It's a special thing. Something that it's almost like a gift that we added on over here. But at the end of the year, it's pretty much gone. We want all year long to be Hashanah, to be a Rosh Hashanah type of year. And that's why we daven in our Shemona Esrei. Borech Aleinu Es Hashanah Hazos. Not Shana Hazos, but Es Hashanah. We want it to be a Hashanah, says Rav Schwab. A special year, something better than anything else. That's the concept that Rav Schwab says over here. But then comes Wolfson, and he just blows out of the park. He says the following. He says, the Pshat is based, he says in Chelek Gimel Daf Kuf Yud Beis, every year you go into the year thinking like a Cubs fan, this is the year. This is the year of Mashiach. This is the year where it can happen.
Every year is next year.
Next year is year? You don't even believe in Mashiach. You put the two together. If the Cubs winning the World Series is equal to Mashiach coming, meaning seems like an impossibility, but we know it's going to happen. We're hoping that it happens soon, speedily in our times. Then in that sense, you start off the year Mireishis Hashanah. In the beginning of the year, Hashanah, this is the year. This is the year we're going to get it. Mashiach's going to be here, everything's going to be all good. And at the end of the year, we realize it's just another year. We lose ourselves in the fact that it just didn't go anywhere. It's no longer Hashanah, it's no longer special. It's just yet another year. Yet another year that just went by without anything. We're just so sad to see it go by. That's how Rav Wolfson understands it. It's such a great hop. That's the pshat, Mireishis Hashanah. We're Mireishis Hashanah, we're starting off with everything. And it's just Shana. It's just Shana at the end of the year. We're hoping, and that again goes into that line from Rav Schwab, Borech Aleinu Es Hashanah Zos. We want it to be Hashanah, not just for Parnassah, but for everything spiritually as well. That's the concept of what we're diving for. So quickly, the way we understood, the way we said today, was we explained why Egypt is not comparable to Eretz Yisrael. We gave four answers as to why Eretz Yisrael was better than the land of Egypt. And conversely, we said that might be scary, based on the Ramban, the Rashbam, and the Abi Ezri, etc. We said the idea of what Mark Twain got to, how the Rishonim were saying there's something good, and Mark Twain saw that in some way that it didn't apply to us, but the Meshech Chochma argued on that. We said how everything is based on, as we said, the Rashi and the Rabbeinu Bachai, which was a Kabbalistic type of thing, the Chidah with the Remez and Nakim and Gorian, and we ended with new Rashi's Hashana, why it's missing an Aleph, and why it might be called Hashana instead of Shana itself. Shabbat, everybody. Let's dive in, Marav. Have a good Shabbat.